Astonishing Legends Network.
Thanks to our sponsors and Patreon supporters, Astonishing Legends is free to listen to. We appreciate your support of them and us.
In Portsmouth, Rhode Island, in the winter of 1673, a boy was sent to bring his grandmother into supper and found her near the hearth on the floor of her room. Her name was Rebecca Cornell. She was 73. She'd crossed the Atlantic from England in her late 30s, raised her children on two continents, and in her last years she lived in a cold back room of a house that had once been her own, put there by the son she'd handed it to, doing the work of a woman half her age. The fire had burned low. When they found her, the coroner looked at the burns and at the ash from her clay pipe, and he wrote down the simplest answer he had: an accident. That would have been the end of it. Rebecca would have been buried, and the record would have called it a misfortune. But a few nights later, Rebecca's brother, John Briggs, woke in the dark and said that she'd come to him, not in memory, but in the room. He said something pulled at the bedclothes, and when he sat up, she stood at the foot of his bed, and she spoke to him to say, "See how I was burned with fire." He proceeded to tell the authorities about this strange experience, and in the Rhode Island of 1673, they took this sort of thing a little more seriously than folks probably would today. So they exhumed her, and sure enough, beneath the burns they found a wound that a fire would not have made. And on the strength of what sounded like a dream, they tried Rebecca's son, Thomas, for her murder, and they hanged him. As far as anyone has found, it's the only time in American law that a ghost's account was entered into the record and the accused went to the gallows for it. 350 years later, people still sit down to dinner in the building on that ground, and some of them, including tonight's guest, say maybe Rebecca and her son Thomas never left. You can read Rebecca Cornell's story in a book that came out just this summer, printed just a few pages from a recipe for penne alla vodka that is now served at Rebecca's former home, because this book is actually a cookbook, written by renowned paranormal investigator Amy Bruni. It's called Cuisine to Kill For: Recipes and True Crime Stories from the World's Most Haunted Places. She's eaten in that restaurant. In fact, it's not too far from the place she now calls home. There are close to 60 locations like Rebecca Cornell's old home and Amy Bruni's new book, each one a real death and a real meal set side by side. Tonight, Amy joins us to talk about how you build a book like that, and why death and drinks, dinners and desserts, turned out to belong together more than even she expected.
Welcome back to Astonishing Legends. I'm Scott Philbrook, and this is Forrest Burgess.
Who doesn't want to dig into a helping of meat stew with polenta and egg from Bran Castle while discussing Vlad the Impaler and his penchant for, well, impaling? Amy Bruni from the introduction of Cuisine to Kill For.
Join us tonight as we sit down with paranormal investigator, author, executive producer, and television creator Amy Bruni to talk about her hundreds of investigations and her newest book.
And we're back.
That we are, folks, and it's good to be back. As you probably noticed, we've been on a bit of a lighter schedule for the summer with the main show, but tonight's episode is the last one like that before we return to our regular, heavier schedule.
Yeah, the Dead Letter Office has been and will remain weekly until we come back with two new main shows for September after we get back from the Wet Hot Bad Magic Summer Camp with Dan and Lindsay Cummins and the Time Suck and Scared to Death crew.
Yes, that is going to be a blast. Listen out for a promo tonight explaining how you can get tickets if you haven't already.
Well, I'm very excited to introduce our next guest, and one I've been waiting for since we started the show, because it's somebody I've heard, everyone's heard about her, if you're interested at all in paranormal investigations and those really fun paranormal shows. But I didn't know much about her and really didn't start thinking heavily about it until we did the Velisca series. Also, this is a great idea. The concept of what she's going to talk about tonight, and we're really proud to present with her, As you may know, when you hear about somebody who's about to be executed, they give them a last meal. Yeah. And I hear all the time, like, oh, it is how my mind works. It's like, oh, I wonder what they picked. And what if you had a big coffee table book of the last meals of people who've been executed? And then as it went on, I realized, like, most of the time it's like a bucket of chicken and a whole pizza. Like,
right, that,
that's
right,
usually,
steak.
It's not, yeah, it's not like, ooh, Chateaubriand for one, please. It's never anything, yeah, it's not Hannibal Lecter choosing his last meal. But this is a really terrific idea for a cookbook, or just a book in general. And her book does something that we always strive for when people ask us if we're ever going to cover a true crime story that they've heard of. And we say, well, we'd really like it to have a paranormal angle. And that's what this book does. It's the best of everything. Yeah.
Well, folks, our guest tonight that we've just been talking about grew up in Alameda, California, in a house where, as she tells it, the neighbors came over for dinner one night and were saying they didn't believe in ghosts. And then right there, a framed picture lifted up off the wall, hung a moment in the air, and then crashed to the floor. Those neighbors never came back. She kept a day job and health insurance until the Ghost Hunters team found the paranormal podcast she was making on the side and pulled her onto the show, where she logged over 100 episodes across 7 seasons. Since then, she starred in and executive produced Kindred Spirits, which we just mentioned, with Adam Berry and Chip Coffee, also for 7 seasons. And on top of that, she built Strange Escapes, a travel company that books paranormal getaways at places like the Stanley Hotel or the Mount Washington Hotel. She hosts the Haunted Road podcast, and she wrote the USA Today bestseller, Life with the Afterlife, followed by the cookbook, Food to Die For. Now, as you heard in the cold open tonight, her new book is Cuisine to Kill For, recipes and true crime stories from the world's most haunted places. And it's out now. We've got copies, and it's excellent. Amy Bruni, welcome to Astonishing Legends.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
It's funny. My wife has worked in television for decades, comedy writer. She worked at Saturday Night Live and all of that. So I've met a lot of celebs over the years. I am more nervous talking to you than any of them. So just bow down very much to you for your career.
It's probably the most unnecessary person to be nervous around.
Well, as you probably noticed, in these fields we're seeing now in the UFO community, a lot of it's personality based. And so people take camps. There's a lot of, infighting back and forth. And there's a few individuals that Scott and I have noticed that stay above the fray. And you're one of them, where you're beyond reproach, as they say.
Which takes effort.
Thank you. They try. Lord, do they try.
Oh, I bet.
I'm always just like, block, mute. Life's too short. I've been doing this for too long. So I always just...
We used to check the reviews and check all that stuff. And it's like, now it's just like, well, I guess if we stink, people will stop listening and we'll go do something else.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we're at. Before you started out, you worked in like insurance. Is that right? You were like, how did you get from there to here? Just like what? Because the other thing is in the opening of Kindred Spirits, you talk about a particular experience, maybe a singular that set you on this path. How did that evolution happen?
Well, when I was a child, I lived in a house that was very haunted, and it does not look like a haunted house at all from the outside. It's a very unassuming little bungalow in Alameda, California, right? So when I was 8 years old, I saw a full-bodied apparition there, and that really just kind of opened the door for me to be interested in the paranormal. I mean, this is the 80s, the 1980s. and I just like, I love watching In Search Of. I would read all these Hans Holzer books. And like, I just really enjoyed the idea of ghosts and the supernatural, even as a child. And we all go through phases, but that was the one thing that never went away. And even like when I was in high school, you know, going to college, working like a normal person on the side, I was on paranormal teams. I was doing research. I was producing a paranormal podcast, all that. So I was like a lot of people that I meet now at events and whatnot and at meet and greets, just like someone who's really interested in it's what they do on the side. And I was producing a show called Beyond Reality Radio, which was hosted by Jay and Grant from Ghost Hunters. And so I became friendly with them. And then they came to film in California because I lived in California and they lived in Rhode Island. They came out to film a couple cases, places I'd been to many times. And so they asked if I would come assist. And I was like, of course. And so I went out and I investigated a couple cases with them, and then I just like never went home. And so at the time, I was working as a project manager for a health insurance company, and I remember like I used all my sick time because I was not sure that this was going to last. And then I just kind of bit the bullet and like just took a leap of faith and gave my 2 weeks and gave the most awkward exit interview ever, telling them that I was leaving this well-paying job with benefits.
Oh my gosh.
That I still miss today. to go for ghosts on a reality TV show. I thought it was going to last a season. I was like, there's no way this is a long-term career, but I have to just do it because I really enjoy it. And I feel like I'm supposed to do this. And then it just kind of went from there.
That's such a great story just about taking a leap and, you know, being able to do that and then have it become so successful and run so long and then evolve into really, honestly, what got you to this book and the book before the other books, which brings us to the next question. Like, how did food get intertwined with ghost hunting and paranormal investigation?
You know,
is it really a meatloaf recipe? Is it Lizzie Borden's meatloaf recipe? Like where, what's...
That was what inspired it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that story. So one thing about me, you know, people are always, I'm just one of those people where like, I will try to take every opportunity to continue making spooky my living in a way that I enjoy and am inspired by. Like I do find that I am a creative person. I really am like severely ADHD. A normal day job is not for me. And so I just am filled with ideas and I have a really creative group of other friends and stuff in the paranormal. We're always just, you know, I love investigating and I love researching, but I also just love to curate and dig into history and think of new inventive ways to like, again, keep this my living forever. And so I saw Lizzie Borden's meatloaf recipe. The Fall River Historical Society posted a picture of her handwritten recipe card that they had. And man, would I love to have that. Like, I would love to have that, but
the ultimate collectible.
But if there's ever a heist and that is stolen, it was probably me. And so anyway, I saw that and I thought, I wonder if people would make that. And you would be eating what the Bordens ate. You would, your house would smell like something they cooked. And like, it's different than, it's more tangible than like looking at photos or taking a tour or something. Like you're really full, you know, senses are all, you know, firing, you're tasting, you're touching the ingredients, you're smelling it all. And so I just looked at it as a way to live a different part of these haunted places. And so that's really what inspired it. So I dedicated the first cookbook, Food to Die For. So there's two cookbooks.
Right.
People get confused on this a lot. There's one that came out in 2024, Food to Die For. And that was the one, that was the first one. And it did very well. So then now, just now we've come out with Cuisine to Kill For, which is the follow-up.
And so people after the first one, they were like, we want more of this and go darker. Is that essentially what you were hearing?
Well, I sort of wanted to as well. The biggest ask that people had, it was funny because when the publisher first approached me about doing a second one, they just really wanted international. We had a lot of requests from people in other countries because Food to Die For did really well in other countries even. They wanted it to be international. So that was their main ask. And then at our first meeting, I was like, oh, and also I'm going to do only true crime related hauntings. And they were like, okay. So I sprung that on them. Because I love true crime. I feel like most women my age, we're watching birds and listening to true crime podcasts. Like,
yeah, just a natural that's what my wife is doing for sure. Yeah.
So that's what we do now.
That's an area Scott and I always look for. Some people are into true crime, certainly a lot of our audience, but we'd like to have a paranormal angle to it if possible, rather than just doing straight true crime because everyone's doing it. And so you managed to do that with a cookbook, which, by the way, is just beautifully produced. And
oh, it's gorgeous.
It's such a joy to just, even if you don't cook, that's our pitch is that the stories are fascinating. They're concise. It's all the interesting tidbits you want to know about each place and great recipes. What I love about what you said in your introduction is that you, with your attitude of do the thing you love, you managed to do two things. One, cooking and baking. And also research on the paranormal and history. And it's just beautifully done. And so it was a real delight to just kind of just read through everything. Now, there's some, as you say, there's some recipes that I probably wouldn't attempt. And as you say, it's got a historical background. So the shrimp wiggle is not maybe going to be your cup of tea. But
surprisingly delicious. Don't disappoint it. It's actually one of my favorite recipes.
Oh, interesting.
But you invented a job. Like you said, I think coming, rarely do people, I think, start off as their first job out of college. Like, I'm going to be a ghost hunter and get to do that. So you've managed to do that and bring it all together. But I think you were able to sort of manifest a job out of this and reinvent something for yourself. And so it's inspiring as well that you were able to do that. But with the book, I noticed there are limits to where it can get too campy, but also because there's true crime, how do you ride that balance between being respectful of the people that suffered some horrible tragedy and died, mm-hmm. and also being entertaining and also providing a good recipe? Because I think the book strikes that balance. But how did you approach that that idea of, like, for instance, it's like you could have a Villisca House pork belly bacon recipe. And for those who know the story, that
there
might
is
be
a Villisca in the first book. We did the Villisca cornbread in the first book.
Oh, so right.
We went there, or else it would have been in this one because it would have been the perfect. But it is hard because there's some subjects, and you'll notice as you read through them, there's a few where I'm like, this is about to get uncomfortable, like just a heads up. You know, like there's the Hinterkaifeck murders, which took place mm-hmm. in Munich, Germany. And that's kind of like their Villisca, and it's really tragic. And so there's certain details I leave out, of course. And this is going to sound really bad, but I really stuck with historic crimes. I didn't do, you know, like what we call freshies, yeah. like anything in the last few decades. I stick with very historic, kind of classically haunted locations and places. And, you know, we do like medieval hauntings, you know, hauntings from the gold rush, you know, that kind of stuff, early 1900s, you know, Victorian era. And once there's that kind of distance placed, it's easier to just kind of make it a little more tasteful. There's a lot of puns that just happen with this book.
Of course, yeah.
I don't even try, they just happen. But I think that, like, if you were doing something more recent where you have like surviving relatives and stuff, like that's where I think it would get kind of distasteful.
Yes.
So that was really it. And there, you know, there were a couple moments, like there was at least one crime where the publisher didn't want to include it because it was too much. And I honestly can't even remember which one that was off the top of my head. It was either that or they read it and they were like, we need to dial this back a little bit. So, like, there's a lot of people that have eyes on that stuff too, in addition to myself.
We can relate to that because we had one, an episode that we mentioned it a few times on the air, but that we wanted to do. And we had friends who were personally involved, but it was connected to a case, a true crime case and paranormal, but survivors are still out there. And it just, there was no way to ever run it. So we just never have.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Sometimes you can do it if you change the names or whatever. Like, there were cases on like Ghost Hunters or Kindred where, you know, a spirit we felt was maybe someone a little more recent. And so we would kind of like change the name and like let it know, like, we've changed the name in this case, just so you know, that kind of thing. But that's the most you can do, really.
So there's one interesting thing in Amy's cookbook that I notice is that all these stories, they all come with some testimony. So you have some from diners, yes. or innkeepers, wait staff, all these folks all going on the record about what they saw. And then when enough people tell you the same thing about the same location, you really start to notice that.
Yeah, it's true. And that's how I pick restaurants. I mean, before I try anywhere new, I read what the people who actually ate there had to say. It's the closest thing to sitting at the table yourself. That's what I like about what BetterHelp's doing right now. They put their reviews out in the open where anybody can go read them.
Yeah, and we've talked about BetterHelp on the show for a long, long time, but we really haven't talked about how much the people who use it really love it. You can really see that for yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews. Now, these are real customer reviews updated every day with hundreds of people describing how much it's helped them.
Yeah, BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews.
Well, more than 6 million people around the world have used it, and these are experienced therapists too. Every one of them has at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of hands-on experience, plus all the required education, training, and certifications across a range of specialties.
And getting started is simple. You answer a few questions, they match you with a therapist based on what you need, and if it's ever a bad fit, you can switch therapists at any time.
So folks, go see the reviews and see what stands out and see if BetterHelp is right for you.
Visit betterhelp.com/astonishing.
That's better, H-E-L-P.com/astonishing.
You know, I'll drive an hour for dinner in a really old building, a tavern with low ceilings, sure. a dining room where the floorboards have some history in them. That's my favorite kind of dinner out.
Oh, yeah, mine too. Isn't there a place near your old Bucks County place that was like that steeped in history kind of thing?
Yes, yes. Remember the steakhouse we used to go to in L.A. together, too?
Oh,
we would
sure.
rendezvous at down in Koreatown, I think it was, wasn't it?
Taylor's, yes.
So Taylor's,
from
yes.
the area, you know. But there's nothing like having a go-to place like one of those in your quiver of choices. Do you even know what a quiver is?
Well, I mean, of course I do. But my son surfs. That's what you call a collection of surfboards, too.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that. Well, what we're talking about
is
a
Robin Hood stuff.
Well, of course. But a place like that, what we're talking about here is that it's a place where you know that it's going to deliver everything you expect it to because it's tried and true, as they say.
Yeah, I agree, man. And that's why I keep reaching for the same Quince shirt when I go out. It's the olive European linen one I got last year and talked about on the show. It's light enough for August. My wife loves the color and it dresses up fine for a nice dinner. What surprised me is how well it's held up a year of steady wear and it still looks new.
Well, that's the whole Quince idea. Fewer, but better pieces. The ones you reach for day after day. For me, I love something that's just simple, like their organic cotton tees, which are absurdly soft. And then once the nights start cooling off, remember I got that Mongolian cashmere sweater? Love it still.
Yeah.
We're talking versatile, timeless stuff. You can wear it for a casual work day and then keep it on for a nice dinner out without a second thought.
And August is a natural reset point before the fall rush. If you're still hanging on to worn out basics, Quince has premium denim and tailored chinos from just $60. The fit, structure, and fabric you'd expect from a luxury designer brand.
And everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for high quality, not brand markup.
Goes past the closet, too. Hotel quality bedding, bath essentials, travel gear, and fitting for tonight's episode, premium cookware. In fact, I just got their stainless steel electric salt and pepper mill set. And nice. I guess that seems like kind of a silly thing, but when we filled them with coarse sea salt and then the whole peppercorns, I am telling you what, salt and pepper have never tasted so good.
Right.
They are legit enhancing our meals, and they're beautiful to look at, and they're well made, too. They have ceramic grinding components, so you don't have to worry about moisture and corrosion. They're truly amazing. I didn't know what to expect, but I've been very happy with them these past couple weeks.
To be honest, I was actually looking at those too, but I decided to get a shirt instead. Anyway, with all these paranormal recipes we get to make now from Amy's book, that's a perfect Quince purchase. So, folks, here's where to start. As Scott made clear, Quince goes way past your closet these days. And yeah, we're talking about cookware, travel gear, bedding, all of it.
Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/AL. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK, too.
That's Quince.com/AL.
This is Caitlin. Thank you for listening to Astonishing Legends. Let's get back to the show.
Did you ever run into a case where something came naturally? And again, it can be pretty campy, but I love that kind of stuff. But take, for example, you have the Donner Party beef jerky recipe or something like, okay, that's, they really did that and they really had that.
So you know what the Donner Party recipe was? Are you ready for it? Because there is a Donner Party on the first book. It was Lumpy Dick, actually.
Okay. See, that's what I'm talking about. And that's, as you said in the book.
I'm
going to
take a pass on that.
No, it's like a porridge dish, and that's what they called it. So it was like an oatmeal. It was very easy to make. Like it was just.
You can make it with almost nothing, like, because if you don't have anything around, right?
And so, but it was just very appropriate, you know. But, you know, like in this book, we have, there's always some of those, like for the Skagway, the Red Onion Saloon, we have the reindeer fart, you know.
See, yeah, I am dying to make that. I haven't done it yet, but I'm like, it's the thing I put in here to try. So
it's dangerous, let me tell you. I tried them in person there. And then I had to recipe test them here. And so I had some friends over and I was like, we're having reindeer farts tonight, my friends. And so I'm like carefully pouring these shots, trying to get them photo ready. And so there were a few attempts, let me tell you.
Right. And that's what's fun about the book. Flipping through, I thought, okay, what's the thing I can make before the interview here that I could attempt and would come out great? And a place, it just happened to be a place that I actually has stayed in a couple of times and done some ghost investigations. And that was the Talbot Inn Tavern Pie. And it was so easy and delicious. Even mom approved. And it was just, again, so you have a range of recipes. So for folks thinking like, oh, these are going to be really exotic and I'm not going to have the ingredients because these are really old recipes. That's not true. These are all things that Amy has pared down, modernized in a way, but also kept true to the spirit of the time. So yes. That's quite an accomplishment. But also, it came out great. It was
delicious. The technicality of what you did with the recipes is really impressive.
Well, it was a lot of work. That talbot pie gave me some trouble, let me tell you. So I'm glad.
Really?
Not me. So this is just the work that goes in behind the scenes, right? So we have to test every recipe before it gets shot by the photographers. And so that was one that I was testing. So full disclosure, I'm a pescatarian, so I don't eat red meat or chicken or anything like that, but I eat fish and shellfish and everything. So I had a writing partner on this who helped test all the recipes. She got all the meat ones. So anyways, we'll go into that. So I had this pie and I made it just like the historic recipe that I had found from the inn. I found this recipe is very historic. I made it. It turned out great. And took pictures of it, sent it off to the team. Well, they're trying to shoot this thing and it is not working for them. They cannot get it to set. It is like mush. And I, to this day, I don't know why mine turned out perfectly fine.
Get a little help from the other side.
So they tried to make it to shoot it. So then my writing partner, Julie, she tried to make it and it didn't work for her. And so we ended up adding gelatin to it, which definitely helped and makes it really easy. Mm. It is delicious. It's like, it's so tangy and yummy. Oh my gosh, I love that pie. But anyways,
yeah,
very strange story. I don't know why mine worked just fine, but thankfully that's why we test the recipes because everyone would have hated me at home.
Oh my God, that's so cool. And Forrest, you didn't have any difficulty with it when you made it?
No, it was, like I said, there's some things, like the salted cod recipe. It's like, okay, that's a little much. Yeah. I will try to make everything in this book. But some things are, it's like, well, I can do that. You know, it's like, I got most of the ingredients on hand. Essentially, it's like a little bit like a key lime pie, kind of a flavor, very citrusy and bright. And it came out very well. And my question leading into that is, during the production of the book and which is a lot of gorgeous photography as well as the recipes and all that, did anything strange happen like that? Did you feel any kind of connection to some hindrance or some aid that seemed kind of odd? Anything weird happened during the making of this? Because we found that too, when you start to poke into this kind of stuff, things do poke back sometimes.
I think it's really interesting that you asked that question because I live in a 300-year-old house, and so there are sometimes when I'm cooking and whatnot, things happen anyway, so I can never really kind of attribute it to what I'm making. But this is where I think we might have stumbled across a new way to investigate the paranormal. So my friend Amanda, Spooky New England, she used to work at the Conjuring House. And so in the first book, Food to Die For, Andrea Perrin gave me her mother's Sunday roast recipe that they made every Sunday, right? And so Amanda was alone in the house one day and she was like, I'm going to make this roast. And so she started making the roast that had been made in that house every Sunday when the parents lived there. And she started having things happen in the house. Like she started hearing people moving around upstairs. And I just wondered, I was like, is food, like, is this the new trigger object? You know, like, is this, is there something to do that?
Like a special.
That's about what Scott was going to say. It's like sometimes I think in the ghost hunting parlance, it could be considered an era cue. Like I've been in places where you play music of the era and we've seen reactions from that. And so do food smells, because it's just another part of the senses where now the smells are coming through. And if you watch the show Ghosts, you know, like the ghosts, they can't taste, but they can smell and they love, they love different food smells. And so that could trigger some activity. And what you're saying is that sometimes that's true.
I mean, it could be. And so one that I would love to try. So like in Cuisine to Kill For, there's a recipe for cranberry cake from the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. And that recipe came from, there was a woman's group I found that they volunteered during the holidays. They would go to Trans-Allegheny and they would bring food and everything, and they would sing Christmas carols, and they would do crafts with a lot of the patients. And I found a journal of one of the women who did this, who was part of this group. And she talked about how it was one of the hardest things she did. She said that they would sometimes have to wear like handkerchiefs over their noses because it smelled so horrible. And that it was just really hard to see the people in this state. And so they just found it really important to try to give them some happiness, like that it was not a happy place. And so I found this cranberry cake in one of their like little holiday cookbooks, right? And so I just imagined them bringing it there. And I was thinking like, what if you made that and brought it in and said, you know, we're here for the holidays, or did like a holiday party or something? Because clearly it was really important to them. And so, yeah, I mean, listen, if I can cook and drink wine and investigate at the same time, like this is it. This is the
whole thing. Talk about manifesting.
Yeah.
The perfect. Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to start with all the cocktails. Forrest has already made the pie. I'm very interested in the, I guess, the Neumann, NYUMEN, which is connected to the Oranbuchi story in Japan.
Yeah, that's a brutal one. That's one of the ones that's a little rough. So it was, the story is that it's a gold mine, right? And so in that area, supposedly there was this group of prostitutes and dancers who knew where the gold was. And so they lured them onto like a bridge for a dance and like cut it. And they all fell, 55 of them, I believe. So it's very tragic. Like, it's honestly one of the shorter stories too, because it's like, that's what happened and it's so awful. But, and obviously that area now, you know, in Japanese culture, they take their spirits and ghosts very seriously. And that area is, you know, reported to be very haunted. But that, the Neumann, is so, it is one of my
favorite. You've had it. You've made that one.
Oh, yes. Like, so like you were touching on, Forrest, how, there's all different levels of cookery in here, right? Anyone can find something to make. And this is probably one of the more complicated recipes, not necessarily to prepare, but
that's
to
what
find.
I
had to order a bunch of the ingredients like off of Amazon or go to like an Asian market, but well worth it. So good.
Well, that's fun too. And like I said, just the stories, even if you're not into cooking, which is funny because my dad and I used to like cooking shows, but we're not going to do any of that. It's just something very relaxing about it, watching, especially like Jacques Pepin. But on the flip side of that, have you ever been to a haunted location? Because this has happened, I've smelled other things at various locations, but you'll get a food smell. Like, I think it's either Waverly or the Randolph County Asylum. Mm-hmm. People will smell bacon cooking and eggs and coffee coming from the old cafeteria. Have you ever experienced that, where you'll smell food smells that are just kind of imprinted on the place?
I have. There's been a few places where I've smelled like bread baking or something. Mm. And then I started Googling. I'm like, am I having a medical episode? Like, you know, they're like,
right. Burnt toast. Toast is burning.
But yeah, no, I've definitely encountered that. And so it just says something, you know, like there is something to food and that comfort level. Like probably for some people, that moment in the cafeteria every day was the highlight of their day. Like it was the, you know, and how many times have we made wonderful memories as humans, just like sitting around a table and like talking and chatting or cooking with your grandparents or whatever. Like there is great power in like preparing food. I love it. It is an art form. I'm not a chef. Like I am no Gordon Ramsay, right? Like this is just my own. I just really enjoy it. And it's one of my favorite things to do. And I've learned that ghosts tend to really hang on to sometimes the simple pleasures, like those become the most important things in life. And we don't really realize that in the day to day, but maybe we really do after we pass.
So here's a question I want to ask too. You know, we've been to a few of the places in the book. One place that Forrest and I stayed at was the Monte Vista in Flagstaff.
Yes.
And was wondering what your experience was like there. I had an experience there. I'll tell it briefly in a minute, but like what happened for you while you, did you guys get anything interesting during your time there?
So the Monte Vista is actually one of those places I've not investigated, but I have been there. So I was doing a tour stop there. So every fall I tour and I do a big speaking tour, and I was doing a stop right up the block from it. And I looked at it and I said, that place is haunted. I guarantee there's some ghost stories. And so I started digging into it at that point. And because I was just curious, I took pictures of it and everything. And then I found out not only was it haunted, but it was involved in this crazy bank heist and everything back in the 70s. And so it was just a perfect fit for the book. But yeah, there are some, what were your experiences there?
It was so strange. And we went in there and we stayed in the same room. We were in town for an overlanding expo. I used to be really into overlanding, you know, with the Jeeps and trucks and stuff.
Oh,
and they
do
this thing in Flagstaff which, by the way, what a great town. Love Flagstaff.
I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so cool. So we were there for a few days taking these classes on, you know, what happens when you flip your car in a puddle and stuff like that. But we were staying in the Monte Vista. The first night we were there, it was a particularly kind of spooky night. Now, we had the windows open, and I have exploding head syndrome, which, have you heard of that? Do you know what that is? Okay.
It sounds so unpleasant.
I know. It sounds crazy.
There's a recipe there, I'm sure.
So yeah, maybe this is the next thing, is like this kind of, because it's just a psychological thing or something. They don't really know what causes it, but it's where you're either on the verge of falling asleep or you might already be asleep, and a very loud sound that seems like it's in the room with you wakes you up. And the sound is so real and present that you get up because you think your cat or your kid or something has happened, you know, like it's... But for me, it's very rare. Like leading up to this moment, it might have happened to me my whole life 4 or 5 times, once every 3 or 4 years, 2 or 3 or 4 years like that. But that night that we were there, I heard a super loud sound that I would have sworn was something falling like into the bathtub in our room.
Wow.
And I woke up and I asked Forrest about it. Now, Forrest, I can't remember. Were you sleeping when I said, I was like, did you hear that?
No, I was awake. But here's the other thing, is that it's a big railroad town. A lot of crossings through there. And I think, Scott, you also thought you heard a locomotive, or you dreamed of a locomotive.
Hear it. I saw it out the window in maybe a dream state or something. I looked out the window and saw a big train right in the middle of the street, but not where the tracks are, like on the street at the Monte Vista sitting. And it had a big old cow catcher, like a joke locomotive from like the Monopoly icon of a locomotive, you know? And it was multicolored, like Disney-esque, which I think might have been in a movie I saw growing up as a kid. But it was down there and it was puffing and getting ready to take off. And that was all that same time. And then Forrest, what did you do with the chair? Thank you.
No, I didn't. I tried to prank him and it didn't. I didn't. I forgot to bring my fishing line, and I was going to get the rocking chair because they do the place upright.
I would have probably left.
And there's you know, everybody's got to have that miniature waiter, a statue with the menu board that you can write on. It was in the room for some reason, so that was a little odd, but it's a great place. And usually, this is usually what happens, is you get to a place and like you don't have the experience. But we just talked to somebody, you know, in the lobby, I believe, or the bar that's next door to it, a terrific little bar.
Next door to the lobby.
Yeah, who said like,
not a next door building. Yeah.
Yeah, because they know about it and it's part of the draw. And they said, you know, do you have any experiences? And we said, no. I said, well, the people next door to you did, in that when you're on the top floor, they heard stomping and footfalls up the wall and on the ceiling.
Oh, that's right.
And it's like, oh, that's somebody above you. Like, no, that's the roof. So there's no possible way somebody's walking around. And they were so disturbed that they just left. So whereas we would book another few nights, of course, if that happened. But we jokingly refer to ourselves as paranormal buzzkills. We get there with the intention and you get no bites on the line. But other people around you do. So it's like you don't get it there, but maybe the place down the street, you get something happening. And so one of the things I'm interested in, and I think a lot of our audience is, that what's a ghost show like to work on and produce? Because, you know, people will, of course, are very entertaining, but they don't know what goes into that, because when you show up, you got to have results. Yeah. That's just television. You know, it's like you wouldn't watch a fishing show where they catch no fish. So before we started rolling, Jill and Roger, who had taken me on a lot of these Midwest ghost hunts, they had stayed doing an overnight at Waverly and, you know, got a fair amount of activity. But as they were leaving in the morning, like 3 or 4 semi-trucks pulled up and they realized that was Ghost Adventures setting up. Mm-hmm. And they have 2 days there. They spend so much money on that. They cover the place. As we used to say in the film production, spray the room so that every angle is covered, because you have to come away with something. And so how do you approach that producing a show like this, where you can't just, well, we spent 3 days of Villisca and we got nothing. And so that was all a waste.
The beauty of being the executive producer and creator is that we could actually be like, we spent 3 days here and got nothing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
I would
never try to like force something. So Ghost Hunters was a much bigger production than Kindred. Like that was, it wasn't semis, like we never had a semi, but it was, you know, there was a lot more crew, but there was also a lot more cast, right? And so I think that there comes a point where, as a paranormal show, you are so well known that you get sent a ton of cases. And so I probably get a dozen people asking for me to investigate their house every single day. And so what we do, well, with Kindred, I can speak to, Adam and I would take all the case requests and we would go through every single one of them and read them. And the ones that seemed the most compelling and active and like needed help the most, we would send those to the producers. And then the production team would reach out to these folks and do like a Zoom interview with them and everything, talk to them about their activity, how recent it is, how active it is. And for lack of a better term, it's almost cherry picking. Like we, you know, once we became well known enough and respected enough, people that were truly, truly desperate came to us. And so we vetted those cases. And so it would be really rare for us to go into a place that actually was not haunted or didn't have any sort of activity. There were definitely a few where like our problem was never activity. It was making sure we had a solution. Like we couldn't leave without some sort of solution for who we were trying to help. Like that would be terrible. And so, you know, there were instances where we had to stay an extra night or two, or we had to like powwow and like really dig into like history and figure out things. So that was our biggest problem on Kindred. Ghost Hunters, it was a lot easier because it was just, and this is one of the reasons why it wasn't really for me after a while, that and having a child, but it was very much like go in and confirm a haunting or say it's not haunted, you know? And it was like, we'd go in and it would be like, and that show relied heavily on our shining personalities to entertain people too, you know? And yeah. So if nothing was happening, Steve and Dave were eating bugs, you know? So it was like,
yeah, so, of course.
And so we would basically at the end of it, it was never like, this is who's haunting, this is what you need to do. It was more like, your house is haunted, good luck, you know, here's how, you know, that kind of thing. It's a little more nuanced than just having to make sure things happen. Like, obviously, it has to be entertaining in any sense. But right. I think that's what kind of sets like Kindred apart, for example, is that we were very, very strict about being very on the level with everything. And, you know, it's very important to us. And I think that's why people love it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But what does a solution or some kind of spirit remediation look like to you folks? Like, what happens when you say we can't leave without some kind of remediation here? What do you do? What's the solution?
Well, it's not crossing them over. I'll tell you that. Like, that's right. The number one thing that right. People are like, why didn't you cross them over and send them to the light, Carol Ann? And I'm like, do you think that I walk in, there's this ghost that's been there for 100 years. And I just walk in and I'm like, that light, you got to go.
You see
that.
The door behind you?
And they're like, no crap. Oh my, I hadn't even thought of that. Thanks, random lady. I wish it was that simple. And people do get like offended at this notion. But in my first book, I have a whole chapter on this. It's actually more intensive than that. And this is, again, it's just my theory. I'll never speak in absolutes. But personally, I think that if you have a truly active haunting that's really aggressively trying to reach out in some way, you know, I'm not talking about like little things here and there that's like very residual, but if you have something that's like, pay attention to me, there's almost always a reason. And that's what you have to figure out. You have to figure out like, why is this spirit so actively trying to get my attention? And sometimes we find when people call people in to like smudge a location like that or move them to the light that apparently like we can't even prove ghosts exist, but we're just going to send them to some mystery light. Right. So what we find in those cases is sometimes that makes it worse because the ghost is like, it's kind of dismissive. You're not listening to me. I'm trying to tell you something and you're just trying to kick me out, you know? And so it could be something as small as like, we've had a spirit that was, their name was misspelled on their headstone and that was making them upset. To a woman who, you know, she was obsessed with birds, like me, obviously, I'm not that obsessed, but the new family moved in and she had like 10 bird feeders that were out back. This woman had died in the house and they tore all the bird feeders out and all of a sudden all of this activity. No. So it's the littlest things. And you just kind of have to get to the bottom of figuring out like what it is exactly. Mm. And sometimes it's as simple as just figuring out who they are and why they're there and not being afraid of them. Sometimes it's just getting their name right or telling their story, but it can take a while. And so that's my theory on it. I wish it was simpler than that. I wish we could just tell energy to move on or whatever, but
it's more complicated.
Sometimes we can, but it's just different.
Did you know that Lucille Ball was terrified of birds?
I didn't know that.
She went into I can't remember if this was a hotel room or a rental or something, and somewhere some bio.
It was a hotel room.
A hotel room, right? She went in and there were birds on the wallpaper and she like left. She wouldn't stay in the room just because they were on the wallpaper.
Crazy. Yeah.
In a follow-up question, is there any place that was too much that it's either featured in the book or someplace that you've investigated where like, okay, it's time for us to go. There's not much we can do here.
You know, I find that the living are much scarier than the dead. And I mean, I am never afraid that a ghost is going to do something to hurt me or scare me. Like maybe they can startle me, but there have definitely been cases where there were living people there that made me incredibly uncomfortable and I left. And there's at least two episodes of Kindred Spirits that were taken out of rotation because the people that were on the episode, something either happened after that was not very good, or both of them. One of them was like harassing us, and then the other one was someone was involved in a school shooting threat. And so that is terrifying, but a ghost is not. I guess one time at Waverly Hills, I did see a full-bodied apparition of a man who looked very like mad at me. I brought up some pretty brutal history, and I think it was that man that it involved. And I remember I left, but not because I thought he was going to harm me, but because I felt like he really did not want me there at that point. And then I was uncomfortable. It's like being in someone's house and you say something awkward and then you're like,
we'll see ourselves out.
Yep. I did that. But you know, that it was that kind of thing. And I also didn't want to see him again because he did look really mad. So like I made Adam lead me out. I covered my eyes. And I made Adam lead me down like 3 or 4 flights of stairs to get out of there. Because I was like, I don't really want to see that guy again.
Wow.
Scott, I think you feel the same way. There's nothing quite like legend tripping or just a good old-fashioned road trip, you know, where you pack the car up, maybe even loosely pick a destination, and then you just head out on the road. And hopefully it's some strange old town or haunted property that you can stay in or near.
It's so much fun. And summer is built for that. And your phone bill shouldn't be the thing that keeps you home, which is where a decade on Mint Mobile has been good to us. We switched back in 2016 or so, my whole family, 3 lines, and between my crew and you, we've saved thousands, enough to bankroll a few of those weekend drives.
Oh, yeah. And the one thing you know when you're out on the road is that you take a lot of photos and you send a lot of photos. And with Mint, it's all held up. I'm talking about the coverage, the call quality, the savings. Mint took what's wrong with wireless and made it right. Premium wireless for $15 a month with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text on the nation's largest 5G network.
And right now, their summer sale makes it even simpler because every plan is $15 a month, even unlimited.
You keep your current phone and your number, then you choose a 3, 6, or 12-month plan and say goodbye to that monthly bill.
Signing up takes just minutes online. So folks, to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/AL. That's mintmobile.com/AL. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/AL. That's it. There's no catch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required. $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra.
Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com. All right, let's switch gears for a minute to talk about one of those things that a lot of people put on their to-do list and then it just sits there, not getting done.
Oh, I got that. You should see how many tabs I have open, which is actually literally slowing down this record as we speak.
Well, I'm telling you, man, that my to-do list is like, it is long and it just doesn't seem to get shorter. Some stuff sits on it for years, like looking into life insurance.
Oh, I've done that too, and I'm doing it right now. And we all know we need it, and most of us just keep putting it off, like I have. It feels complicated or expensive, or like a problem for some future version of ourselves. And then later, never quite shows up on the calendar, especially the stuff that's really about taking care of your family.
It's exactly the kind of thing you can knock out with SelectQuote. In about 15 minutes, you could have coverage that fits your life and your budget. Here's what makes them different. Their licensed insurance agents work for you, not for one insurance company. They compare options across multiple carriers to find you the right coverage at the lowest price.
And they've been doing this for nearly 40 years, and they've helped over 2 million people find coverage. And I can personally vouch for the agents. You know, when I was sorting out health coverage for my folks, the SelectQuote people I dealt with, you know, they were patient and straight with me the whole way. There's no runaround and there's no pressure.
And if your health has some history to it, they can still help. I've got high blood pressure, for example, so I get it. Their agents know which carriers will give you the best rate for your specific situation. High blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, whatever.
And if you're healthy, they can get you same-day coverage with no medical exam.
Plenty of brokers push the policies that pay them the most. SelectQuote's agents actually shop for you. They shop, you save.
So stop telling yourself you'll handle it later, folks. Handle it today.
Get the right life insurance for you for less at selectquote.com/AL.
Go to selectquote.com/AL today to get started.
Hey everyone, I'm Luke Rogers, and when I'm not chasing spirits, either ethanol or ethereal, I'm listening to Astonishing Legends. Now, back to the show.
Have you heard of the shadow person or the elemental there that's kind of a shadow thing that has bad physical effects afterwards?
Is that the thing that James Willis saw?
Well, a friend of ours supposedly saw
thing it. Thing on the ceiling?
Yeah, there's the creeper. There's so many, there's a huge cast of characters there. But have you ever felt in danger? Because that is one where someone we know saw, looked directly at whatever this creature was of that, and then had some health effects afterwards that he feels is attributable to his sighting there. Have you ever felt, and again, just feeling uncomfortable, have you ever had any lasting effects, the hitchhiker effect from some of these places?
No, I feel like a lot of that is confirmation bias, to be honest. Like, you know, I think that if you are going in and you're expecting something like that, or you see, and then afterwards something happens to you, it's really easy to go back. I think this happens a lot with like Ouija boards or people going to certain locations, or people going around the Annabelle doll, whatever it may be, anything that happens to them after that, they were like, it's that, it's the Ouija board. You know, it was right. That, you know, they go back and they blame it, or they are so hyper aware in that moment when something is happening that they're noticing everything about, I mean, think about like, so I suffer from panic attacks and the physical effect that it takes over me based on a mental trigger is insane. You know, people think they're dying, think they're having heart attacks. They can't breathe. Like, our bodies, especially when we're in like a fight or flight situation or a high stress situation or where our senses aren't feeling like, you know, you can't see as well and you're in an old building, our bodies do things that are just wild. And so I always am very hesitant to attribute any physical effects to myself or anybody else to the power of a ghost. And I think, you know, I think that's one of the things is that people are just naturally, they're very afraid of the unknown. And it can manifest in many different ways. And so that's why, you know, like I've been ghost hunting with my child since she was like 4 years old. She was in my womb. I went into some of the scariest places in the world. She's been investigating since she was in the womb. I wouldn't put her in those situations if I ever felt like it was truly unsafe. And, you know, my mom was the same way. So maybe that's why, like, I've just never been taught to be afraid of ghosts. And so.
This is very comforting to me personally, which leads to my next question, because first of all, I don't suffer on the regular from panic attacks, but I have had one. I know the exact feeling you're talking about. Mine was related to a renovation.
See, and that's scarier
was
than any
renovation ghost. and a permit guy in Los Angeles who was telling me that I was going to have to tear down most of what I had done. Oh, and I remember the day he came by, and speaking of humans being more evil than anything we've ever encountered or covered, aside from murderers, of course, this guy was up there.
Oh my God.
And I remember he left and I was like, oh, great. We're going to tear down this thing that cost us a fortune and took 2 years off my life. And I won that war in the end, but man, I closed down. I got down on the floor. My heart was pounding. Mm-hmm. No one was home. I was by myself. And I know that feeling. So I feel for you. And with regard to that, I can relate to that. Here's the thing I want to ask you about. And we talked a little before we started recording for our listeners. And of course, they've even got a drinking game about the Sally House. But I'm going to bring just very briefly, bring it up and file 10 and the DR60. Mm-hmm. Folks, if you don't know what that is, or you're hearing this for the first time, just check our back catalog. There's many, many hours of talk about it. But you did listen to File 10. You do use the DR60 frequently in the field. You guys were getting on Kindred Spirits, the episodes that that I've seen anyway, you were getting a lot of very clear Class A and or close to Class A EVPs where you can hear words. There is also the phenomenon of the Screaming Man, which is what we got. And then I had a whole series of events that I felt like were connected to my experience there, because when I got that recording, it felt very personal. And then for 6 or 8 months, I had a bunch of strange things happen. And I know what confirmation bias is. You could be completely right. Everything that maybe it was all coincidental or I was up in my head, and I was all the way back in Los Angeles and this house is in Kansas. So my question for you is, what was your take on File 10 and what do you think of the Screaming Man phenomenon with DR60s?
Well, so first of all, I just want to say it's really, I always tell people that have been in your situation, because like Velisca, John Worley was very in a very similar situation where he had an experience and then afterwards a bunch of things happened. And he blamed that experience. And it's important to remember that correlation is not causation. It's really important, because I've had some really scary stuff happen, you know, over the years, or things that would be scary to many people. And then, you know, maybe afterwards something happened. Maybe, you know, someone I know got sick, or maybe my cat died or whatever. It's very easy to go back and be like, you know, this is me. I had this thing. And it's just very easy. But like, we also have to remember that minus those strange occurrences, every once in a while, we have a really bad run in life. Like sometimes just things happen and they pile up and like, it just all happens at once. And it feels like your luck can't possibly get worse. And you're like, there has to be, that's why we're like, is Mercury in retrograde? You know, is it a full moon? Like something's going on because everything sucks right now. And it's very easy to forget that that just happens sometimes naturally, regardless of outside forces. Like that's just life. Sometimes, and you got to pay attention to this, sometimes you have an amazing run where everything's going great, you know, and you, and like, we have to remember, like, you manifest that, because that, you know what I mean? So just remember that. But that being said, that file.
Yes.
So I've used the DR60 now. I was introduced to it many years ago by Mark and Debbie Constantino. I used to work with them a lot in California. And so they introduced me to that. And I think it's one of those things you do have to be really careful with, because it is very, very sensitive. But I have gotten EVPs like that many, many times. That exact sound, that exact, like almost
that file 10 that you listened to.
10. Yeah. And my theory on that is that almost every voice, like sometimes they'll come through as like a whisper and you can even tell if it's a man or a woman. Other times it's very guttural and almost growly. And I just really think that the way that that recorder records, sometimes depending on either where they're positioned or what kind of energy they have or they're using, I think it can come through and sound very, very scary. And I think, you know, even when you talk into it, you know, experiment with it. Because I've done that where like—
You sound weird when you play yourself back.
Or I'll like scratch my coat to see what kind of sound that makes. Or like, I try not to assume that anything, because like I've had disembodied voices, you know, in my ear that are like, help me, you know, and it sounds so terrifying, but they're asking for help. And I'm like, I have to ignore the fact that you sound like a dinosaur in my ear asking for help. So I just think that I try to take anything that sounds that terrifying from the DR60 with a grain of salt, because it is pretty common.
Right. For sure.
So maybe that helps as well.
No, it does help. And, you know, some people have said that in the past, a few people, because a bunch of people have weighed in, listeners and other folks who have experience with it over the years. And some have said, it's not mad. It's just having a problem being an effective communicator or, you know.
Well, humanize it. You know, like I always tell people, like, once you humanize your ghosts and you really think about what they're trying to do or get through to you, it becomes a lot less scary. Like even being grabbed by a ghost or touched or what, you know, like they're trying to get your attention or a door slamming. You know, it seems very scary at the moment. But when you think like, okay, well, why are they doing that? Like what's happening? It doesn't seem like they're doing that to scare me. Like they clearly want something. Like, and put yourselves in their shoes. Like you know, if they touch you and you react, they're probably just as startled. And so that's why I tell people, like, talk to them like you would talk to anyone else in the room. I tell people, don't bring up their demise. I always look at people for how they lived, not for how they died, you know, that kind of thing, all that stuff. So I guess I'm just a big old softy when it comes to God.
Well, and that's probably why they want to talk to you.
Maybe. Yeah.
You have a calming energy, as Walter White said. I'm a calming presence.
Well, one thing that we noticed, because we did a couple of episodes on Villisca and watching that episode that you did, again, getting back to having to come up with some results, is that you did a little provoking, which you clearly said in the show, like, I don't do this. I don't think this is right, but we're not getting any reaction. And you did. And then you did get a reaction, which was not very nice. But do you think that that was something that, why didn't it happen before? Was it the provoking, or you just kind of demanding, like, look, if you're here and you did something bad, we, you know, we want to hear from you. And then you did. Do you think that that was related, or, you know, it's that, proposition of post hoc ergo propter hoc, where you, because I yelled out, I provoked, and then we got something. Was that really connected? Do you think that, did you feel something other than just, oh, there's something now on the recorder that we didn't get before after I?
So here's the thing, like, people ask me a lot about demons and everything, like, are demons real, or, you know, and I remind people that really terrible, awful people die too, and could potentially become ghosts. So I think it's easier for us to, like, put the label of demon on something, and because we can't imagine a human would be that mean or terrible, right? But here's the thing. So Villisca, I feel as though occasionally, I think sometimes that murderer comes back there. And I've heard of this before, you know, like somebody who was awful in life, you know, like they're still awful and they relive that. Now you have this situation with Villisca where people are constantly rehashing what happened there. Like, when you go in there and you talk to the, you know, you talk about the family holidays and the cooking, you know, the mm-hmm. good times, like, nothing happens. But the second you start feeding into, like, the horrific things that happen there, you start getting activity, which, who knows, right? But here's a fun fact that we didn't get to talk about on the show, but I've talked about this on my tour a lot. So as you guys know, John Worley was our client on that show. He emailed me several times thinking that he got an EVP there that said, just kill John Worley. Mm-hmm. And he was terrified. After that, a series of bad things happened to him. And he was convinced it was because he got this EVP that said, just kill John Worley, right? So we're leaving, we get the case wrapped up, we've gone through this with him, like what I just went through with you, correlation, not causation, get him back in the location, we investigate together, everything's great, he's doing very, very well. We kind of just counseled him through it, right?
Great.
I get to that little airport, wherever we were flying out of, and I'm a research, like, I get research rapture where I can't stop. Like, I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm not done, even though the show's wrapped, I'm just like, I'm down, I feel like I'm close to something. So there was a gentleman by the name of William, there was a man who was a suspect of this murder. And I lecture about him so much, I can't.
I'm so glad you're touching on this, though. This was my question. Like, if you're in contact with this spirit, like, why didn't you guys ask who did it? Who done it? Because it's an unsolved mystery.
We asked many times.
Okay.
So here's the thing. So this man who was heavily investigated, right? So there was a local detective who
honed in
on this man. And I don't think we talked about him on the show, though. So
No. We did. We covered it, too. And it's coming back from our research.
Another guy who was actually seen, I believe, in Clarinda, Iowa. And he said that he had taken the train from Villisca the next day, right? And so this guy, William Mansfield. Sorry.
Okay. Oh, well, that's all right. Like, yeah.
Escaping me. But, and so I know his last name is Mansfield. I'm pretty sure it's William Mansfield, but I could be wrong. But listen, my brain, it's not all right. So this man was being heavily investigated for the murders because he was in, I believe it was Kansas City and somewhere in Colorado. And at the same time that he was in those locations, very similar murders happened where people were murdered with an axe and there was draping over the mirrors, all of the same things that happened at Villisca. And so then even after the Villisca murders, this guy randomly, his in-laws and his wife and kid all end up getting murdered by an axe murderer. And like, and the newspaper is just says, you know, we can't find the husband. And we're like, I wonder why you can't find the husband. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so it was this guy, William Mansfield. So I was digging into this guy because it was set, he got exonerated because they brought him to trial. He was exonerated because he proved that he was working in Kansas City the day of the murders because he came up with some random pay stub and that was all it took. And so they were like, well, it couldn't be him. He's got a pay stub. He was working in Kansas City. Can you imagine? Anyways, so he used aliases and one of his aliases was George Worley. And so when we listened back to that EVP, it could also be saying just kill George Worley, not John Worley, but also just the fact that John Worley had the same last name that this man used. We wanted to go back. We wanted to film. We were like, but the network was like, no, we're done giving you money for this episode. And so I talked to John Worley about it. I lecture on it. So I thought that was really interesting, that EVP. And that's what led me. I started looking up Worley and Villisca murders, and that's where I found that man. So
what do you think the source for the EVP would be then? It wouldn't be...
I don't, well, yeah, is it someone who's like, is it one of the family members
right.
who's like, oh my God, this guy's name is Worley, kill him, you know, or something? Like,
right,
I don't know.
Right. Wow.
I mean, I wish I could find, you have to find the picture of this man because he okay. absolutely did it.
Okay. Okay.
Yes.
We'll find it. We'll find it. Wow.
Okay, so now after hearing about all these amazing places, I think we should go. So I've been making a list of just places we need to visit by car, hopefully. And that includes a road trip, a very long one.
Oh, yeah. How many states are we talking about here?
At least the lower 48, okay? So and for that, we're going to need enough snacks. We're going to need a large cooler, a very patient navigator.
Yeah, and a reliable ride with good mileage or good range if you go electric, which might be me this time. My son's driving the Land Rover now, and the lease on my daily driver is about up. So step one is the car itself. And these days, that means car gurus. They have a search feature called Guru where you describe what you want in your own words. I'd type maybe comfortable on a long haul, room for recording gear, gas or EV, and it shows you real available listings that match.
Yeah, there's no menus, no 20 little filters you got to set. You search the way you describe it to a friend. And they've made the money side clearer too. So when you shop on Car Gurus, look for the price includes fees label. Those listings show a breakdown of the dealership fees you can expect. So you're comparing real numbers up front.
Then, once you're standing on the lot, dealership mode in the Car Gurus app puts you in control. You compare cars side by side, check pricing, and estimate your final cost, all before you sign anything.
And with more than 4 million listings, Car Gurus has the biggest selection of cars out there, so it's easier than ever to find the right car and the right deal.
It's no wonder Car Gurus is the number one most visited car shopping site according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. So folks, our legend tripping tour is going to need the right vehicle, and your next big deal deserves the same homework.
Buy or sell your next car today with Car Gurus at cargurus.com.
Go to cargurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal.
That's CARGURUS.com.
Cargurus.com. So we've had some pretty intense experiences out in the field over the years, as longtime listeners no doubt have heard. But this September, we're packing up those memories and taking them straight into the woods.
And not just any woods, the Pennsylvania woods. You know, there's a wet, hot, bad, magic, palpable energy out there and a history of high strangeness that just kind of hangs in the air. It's the perfect setting for what we're about to do.
Our Patreon supporters have heard this already, but we've got some exciting news. We're officially on the lineup for the 2026 Wet Hot Bad Magic Summer Camp happening September 10th through the 13th at the Acres in Equinunk, Pennsylvania.
Yes, we were graciously invited by the powerhouse duo of Dan and Lindsay Cummins and their incredible crew from Time Suck and Scared to Death to their third year of this awesome summer camp. It'll be a gathering of space lizards, Roberts, Annabelles, and now you, our listeners.
A totally judgment-free zone to just let your freak flag fly. But we aren't just going to hang out, do archery, and watch the Ninja Warrior course. And I wonder if you can combine the archery with the Ninja Warrior course.
What do you mean, like that event where you shoot arrows while attempting to conquer obstacles? I'm not sure that exists.
Well, if it did, I feel like I'd be good at it.
Yeah, didn't you tweak your knee going up the stairs to your studio the other day?
You know, not everything I tell you before we press record is for the world. Yes, I did.
Okay, that's what I thought. Well, I'm sure you'll be better by then. You know, they're going to have a ton of great stuff going on at Wet Hot Bad Magic Summer Camp 2026. In addition to that stuff, there's also going to be speed friending.
Ooh, nice. That's what I used to call riding the subway in New York. But the main thing we will be there to do is a live show. Right. We're going deep into the dusty boxes of evidence in the basement of Blanket Fortiana for this one, digging down on our own past field work.
Yep, and we're going to be talking about some of our most chilling personal experiences. The visceral off-mic moments from our time at the Sally House, take a shot, or the various lockdowns I've attended, like those long dark hours inside Waverly Hills Auditorium. The evidence we gathered and the feelings that stuck with us. Telling those stories out there in the dark, surrounded by that camp atmosphere, it's going to be unsettling in the best possible way.
And it's an all-inclusive weekend. Dorm-style cabins, meals, drinks, live bands, comedy. It's a four-day, three-night escape. Tickets go incredibly fast for this, folks, and we want to see you there.
So come find us by the campfire.
Head over to badmagicproductions.com or just click the link in our show notes to grab your tickets for the 2026 Wet Hot Bad Magic Summer Camp. We'll see you in the woods.
Hi, this is Elizabeth, and when I'm not casting spells, I'm listening to Astonishing Legends. Let's get back to the show.
By the way, speaking of that research and everything, I think the other thing's interesting that you do, and we like to try to do this too, is you're pretty honest about the facts with the stories in the cookbook about, you know, the number of H.H. Holmes, how many murders are attributed, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How do you feel about like correcting those details when you find information that's different?
I love history and I love research. And I think that sometimes with the paranormal, there's this like kind of paranormal game of telephone that happens or a game.
Sure.
And I think that especially back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of psychics would go into locations and they would be like, there's a little girl named Mary who haunts this place. She died in a well and, you know, whatever. And everything they said was just taken as gospel. And people just passed those stories down for generations, right? Not to discredit psychics, but I will never believe anything that comes out of a psychic's mouth until I can verify it with history or evidence on top of it. Not in a malicious way. I take it all with a grain of salt. Like, and I will use that information hopefully to guide me to other things for sure. And I love when that happens, but I will never just take only what a psychic says and just run with it. And so that being said, there's been many cases where we've had to kind of correct history because there have been either it's been told wrong over the years or it was just kind of lore created and legend and not even true. And so it's one of those things when people say, I don't care if you believe in ghosts or not. I'm not going to try to convince anybody of the existence of the paranormal, but like I will do everything in my power to get the history right. That's the one thing that I can document and prove unequivocally, you know, and so it's really important to me. And I think I find it to be really important for the idea of ghosts too, because this is their memory, this is their legacy. And if we're misstating it, or maybe we're not even mentioning people that should be mentioned, like I think that's really important.
Oh, that's really well put.
Yeah. So what is it like working with Chip Coffey and or having a medium on the show, which is, again, we feel kind of the same way where I think you're getting information. If we trust the person, it's coming from somewhere. We're just not certain where the information is coming from or where it's directed. And I've certainly been on, it's funny, I've been on a couple of ghost hunts where a medium who wasn't with us, but predicted that something would happen. The thing happened, but not to the person they thought. Mm-hmm. Like they thought it was going to happen to me, but it actually happened to somebody we were with. And it was like, that's pretty spot on. It's just a little bit off.
Yeah.
So when you work with somebody like that, how does that affect the investigation? And does it bring anything positive or negative to it?
Well, I love working with psychics and mediums. And I find the ones that I work the best with are the ones that admit fully that they are fallible, that they are not the end all, that what they say, it, you know, because, you know, there's many times I've been the victim of like a psychic ambush. I don't know if you have, if, you know, and I, if a psychic comes to me out of the blue and starts telling me stuff, I'm like, no, you know, ones that don't entertain that kind of like doing things like that, or they're like very honest about their impressions and like want to work with you to try to verify what they're getting. And that is the kind of psychic I like to work with, like realizing that they are doing their best and like not everything they say is going to absolutely be right, or it might not even make sense in that moment, or maybe it's something that's kind of, you have to interpret it in some way. And so I like to work with Chip. I love working with Chip. He's one of my best friends, but he hates when I say this, but I'm like, you're one of our tools. Yeah. Right. And yeah. I like to bring him in completely cold. So mm-hmm. like he's doesn't know anything about the location. Half the time he doesn't even know where he's going. A lot of times we would blindfold him and bring him in because sometimes we're so recognizable that if he saw it, and I love doing that, you know, and I work with Sarah Lamos now a lot and she's kind of the same way. But like when they are good, they're spooky good. And like some of the stuff that they say, you're like, holy crap, like how could you possibly have known that? And so mm-hmm. I definitely believe in the idea of psychics. I just like to make sure I verify what they say because I don't want to be passing that information on the times that they could possibly be wrong. And they don't want to do that either. Any good psychic.
Well, circling back, it's a perfect segue when you're talking about the history and getting the history right, because one of the stories in Cuisine to Kill For centers around the Valley Inn, which we gather you live not too far from, I think.
It's very close.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So it's a place that you've had a lot of experience with over the years, and then it made it into the book along with the recipe. But before we get to that, can you just briefly, like a brief overview for our listeners of the story of Rebecca Cornell or Briggs Cornell and what happened there? Because what was interesting to me between Cuisine to Kill For and also that episode of Kindred Spirits was even the story that the current owner told you, which was very lore-based, there was some factual information that you found out was counter to some of the things that he had heard. Can you just do like a brief overview on that and how that story is unfolds in your book?
I went to the Historical Society and found like an actual, like actual trial transcripts and stuff. So I think that was really helpful in kind of correcting some of the lore. But the story of this, so the Valley Inn it's a very old house that has been there since, like my house was built in 1723. And I think the original house there was built in the 1600s. And it did burn down at one point, but still there is the whole original basement and foundation is still there. So and the house was kind of built in exactly the footprint that it was originally. But so Rebecca Cornell was a woman, she was in her 70s, and she lived with her son, Thomas Cornell, in that location, and their family was around and everything. But this woman was 73 years old, right? I don't remember exactly the year, but it's the late 1600s, whatever. And this poor woman's living with her son and he's making her work in the fields and making her, he won't turn the heat on. You know, he won't like put enough coal in the fire and she's miserable. And she's like, I'm going to go move in with his brother. Right. This is kind of neither here nor there. But anyways, one night she leaves dinner early and later that evening she is found half inside and out, halfway inside the fireplace, burned to death. Like she is burned. And they're like, it was an accident, you know?
Right.
So basically her ghost appeared to John Briggs, who I can't recall if this is her brother or if there's someone else that she knew.
Yeah. I think it was her brother.
I think it's her brother.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So her ghost, he wakes up in the middle of the night and he says that he sees the ghost of Rebecca and she says, see how I was burned with fire. And she was in fact burned, right? And so he takes that to the authorities and he's like, Rebecca was murdered. She came to me in a dream. And so Thomas Cornell at one point had said that he thought his mother was always asking for a good fire and God made sure she finally had it. And so did not help him at all.
Right.
So he was tried and convicted of the murder and hanged in Miantonomi Square in Newport, Rhode Island. So there's a whole trifecta here. So the house is over here. And then he was tried at the White Horse Tavern and then hanged at the local park, right? And so the White Horse Tavern was featured in book one too. So, but anyways, it's the only time in American history that someone was executed based on the testimony of a ghost. Some people will bring up something called the Greenbrier Ghost in West Virginia, which not to get too far into that story, but that one was different because the mother of the murder victim, she went to a medium, and the medium told her that her daughter had been murdered by her husband. Right. And so they actually used that testimony to try to discredit her. So that was used by the defense to be like, we can't believe anything this woman says. Look at her. She's going to a psychic, you know?
Right.
And so it was not used to convict, but obviously the jury heard it. So who knows if they used, if it changed their minds at all. So that's the difference in those two cases.
I also think about Teresita Bassa.
That's right. I was about to mention that.
Yeah. Do you know her story?
No.
That's an Unsolved Mysteries. No, it's where the, after she was murdered, she came in a dream to someone who didn't know her and was like, you got to check all this stuff happened to me. It's an Unsolved Mysteries, but it led to new evidence, but the testimony of the ghost wasn't part of the conviction.
Yes. And that's the big difference is that they were like, everyone then was like, oh, the ghost said so. So, but what's great about the Valiant is that, so Thomas Cornell, his family, when they received his body back, they asked for it to be buried as far away from the family plot on the property as possible, which incidentally is under the parking lot at the Valley Inn. So we found his grave using ground penetrating radar.
Yes.
But the recipe in there is one of my favorites in the entire book.
Penne alla vodka.
Penne alla vodka. So I tried to get this recipe from Joe. So the owner, Joe, we go there a lot. It's pretty nearby. I tried to get that recipe for the first book and I told him the concept and Joe's very no nonsense, very Italian, very New England. And he was just like, absolutely not. And these are all of his like family recipes. They're only the third family to own that property. So
that's amazing.
He's only in all of this time. So maybe even the second, I think he bought it from the Cornells. Anyways, when Food to Die For did really well, I went back and I was like, so listen, I'm doing another one and it's true crime related hauntings. And it is the perfect book for your restaurant. And so begrudgingly, he handed over this penne alla vodka recipe, but it was not easy. It took me 5 years to get that recipe from him. And it's his mother's recipe. And he still wouldn't give me the recipe for the marinara sauce.
That's the secret. But it's like you said, it was very good. But you said in the book, it might be a little bit better at the Valley Inn.
Yeah. So we're doing a book club there actually at the end of August. And he's serving the penne alla vodka.
Oh, there you go.
What's your favorite recipe from the book, if you have one?
My favorite personally. So there's quite a few. It's always hard. It depends. People ask me this and I answer differently all the time. But the one I'm actually making for dinner tonight is the oven roasted cod from the Omni Parker House. That is so good. And that was one of those recipes that I had to really.
Maybe I'll try that one.
Yeah.
I'm down at the beach, so I can get all that stuff pretty. Yeah.
I find that it's really important to make it in a cast iron. That's it makes a difference.
Oh, I'm glad you said
What do you think is the easiest recipe for someone who just bought the book, they're going to run out to the store? What's the best one to attempt on a first try?
Oh, gosh. Well, almost any of the cocktails are pretty easy. Mm. I would say that the Marilyn from Bobby Mackey's was given to me directly from them. Right. And it's like three ingredients. Can't lose with that one. And then the shortbread is... Mm. Oh, I think it's from Edinburgh.
Oh, Edinburgh. Nice.
So that's shortbread.
One quick thing. When you guys, when you did the Kindred Spirits and Thomas didn't want to be moved from, it seemed like he wanted to be in the parking lot, not near his family.
Like, I'm good. I hate my family.
But do you still think he did it?
I don't know that he did. I really don't know that he did. Yeah, it seemed like there was another, like when we were doing the S's method there, I'd have to refresh it, but I honestly...
I watched it this morning, so if you have questions, I can answer them on your episode.
I feel like at the time I wondered if John Briggs had something to do with it, or someone someone was like lying through. It was very weird.
Because he benefited, I think, financially from...
Yeah.
Because then both of them are out of the way, because he was the brother, from what I remember. So maybe... Maybe that was how he got the property or something. Huh.
Who knows?
Well, Thank you so much for coming on the show and taking the time to be with us today. This is a true honor. It's been a lot of fun. Tell people where they can find Cuisine to Kill For, where they should be buying it. And
yeah,
if there's any other projects you're working on that you want to share, please do.
For sure. So Cuisine to Kill For, you can purchase it anywhere books are sold. If you have a local indie bookseller you'd like to support, I mean, obviously you can also just grab it on Amazon. If you don't have Food to Die For yet, grab that too. They look
beautiful. I'm going to get it.
Together, like they are stunning together. And also this fall, I do have a new show coming out on Beacon TV called It Followed Me Home. So
Will
be premiering this fall. So stream beacontv.com for that. And Adam's on it as well. And it's like, I go back to my hometown and it's very dramatic, very wild. So check that out. And yeah, anything else, just go to my website, amybruni.com.
Great. Well, folks, that's Amy. Thanks for coming on the show. Yes, and a good place for independent bookstore support is bookshop.org. You can find local, they'll direct you to local bookstores if you want to be loyal to somebody near you. Thank you again so much. And we hope, and you're welcome back anytime. If you have any experiences that you want to come on and talk about, you know how to reach us. We would love to have you back.
All right. Thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
That's going to wrap up episode 334 of Astonishing Legends. Special thanks to Amy Bruni for joining us tonight. Pick up her book, Cuisine to Kill For, at bookshop.org to support local bookstores or on Amazon. This episode marks the end of our lighter 2026 summer schedule. We'll be back with two main shows in a row in September. Keep an ear out for new episodes of the Dead Letter Office weekly on Tuesdays. If you join us at patreon.com/astonishinglegends, you can hear all of this content early and commercial free. If that's not your thing, remember that all of our shows are free to listen to right here on our main feed. Help us out by subscribing, leaving reviews, and telling your friends and family about us. And please remember to support our sponsors when you can.
Astonishing Legends is edited by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. Our co-producer is Tess Feifel, who also leads our research efforts and manages our social media. And we're grateful for the hard work of our technical producer, Ed Vacola, behind the scenes. Special thanks to our announcer, John Bolin, for lending his voice to our shows.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Beattie.
Hi, I'm Luke Rogers, and I give permission to Astonishing Legends.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Coley.
Present or future compensation.
I understand this is with no implied promise of
K-O-E-L-L-E.
Our theme, which is available as a ringtone, was composed by Judson Crane at foundermusic.com. All other music and sound design for the show is composed and created by Alan Carestia.
Our logo was created by Tommy Beaver Design, and our animated graphics for social media and YouTube are done by Joshua Sloan at deadstreetproductions.com.
Many episodes have transcripts available. For ones that don't, you can request them by emailing transcripts@astonishinglegends.com.
Astonishing Legends would not be possible without you, our listeners. Visit our store at astonishinglegends.com or interact with us and other listeners on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Discord, and YouTube.
You can also visit us at patreon.com/astonishinglegends, where patrons have access to commercial-free versions of both the main show and the Dead Letter Office, as well as additional bonus content, including the Patreon-exclusive show, The Astonishing Junk Drawer. No part of this show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.
Good night.